two had a lot of arguments. Afterwards, we joked about them. Carrie was a flirt and liked to see me get mad, but we always made up.
What about the night of the party? Did you have a quarrel?
Carrie had had a couple vodkas. She never could handle any liquor well, even a glass or two of wine. So when Chris Kobel started flirting with her, she kept flirting back with him.
Had you been drinking?
Yes, I just had a couple of beers.
A couple?
Maybe three or four, I'm not really sure.
Alan was very aware that his parents were now glaring at him.
I understand you left the party before it was over. Where did you go?
I knew some of my friends would be at a local pizza restaurant, Nelly's, in Waldwick. I met them there.
Did you stay with them until you went home?
No.
Did you go directly to Carrie's house from the restaurant?
Yes.
Was she there when you got there?
She was out on the patio in back of the house cleaning up.
What did she say when she saw you?
She didn't say anything. I said, Carrie, I'm sorry, I just want to help you clean up.
How did she respond to that?
I'm tired, I'm getting up early in the morning, I want to go to bed now.
Did you leave then?
I could tell that she meant it, she was yawning. So I said, I'll see you tomorrow.
What happened next?
She said, okay, let's talk tomorrow.
And what did you do then?
I gave her a hug and a kiss and went home.
What time did you get home?
June jumped in. We were in the bedroom. I looked at the clock. It was exactly 11:51. A look of annoyance came over Parker's face.
Alan, do you agree? Was it around 11:51?
No, I think it was a little later.
It was exactly 11:51, June interjected. As I told you, I was looking at the clock when Alan came in. There was a pause, and then Lester Parker turned to the Crowleys.
I wonder if you would mind waiting outside.
The best way I can help Alan is if I hear the facts directly from him.
When the door closed behind them, Parker said,
Alan, we have attorney-client privilege. Nothing you tell me will be shared with anyone. In any way, shape, or form, did you either hit Carrie or push her in the pool?
Absolutely not.
Alan's expression and body language were fiercely defensive.
How would you feel if everyone in town thought you were a murderer?
He burst out.
How would you feel if your parents were so sure you were going to get arrested that they hired a hotshot lawyer to defend you? How would you feel if your girlfriend who you really loved got murdered?
Alan's lips quivered. Lester Parker studied Alan. He had heard many defendants plead their innocence and could often detect who was lying and who was telling the truth. He was still reserving judgment on Alan Crowley as he prepared to offer a defense for him.
When did you learn that Carrie was dead?
About noon on Sunday. I was outside mowing the lawn and my cell phone was in the house. When I went in to get a bottle of water, I could see there were a lot of messages and texts. I read one of the texts and found out what happened. As I was reading the message, a detective came to the house and asked me to go down to Hackensack with him.
Did you tell him exactly what you're telling me?
Yes, I did.
Alan, it must have been very scary for you to go down to the prosecutor's office and get videotaped. Did you say anything in that interview that was not true?
Alan hesitated.
It's okay, Alan, Parker said. You can tell me.
I told the detective I stayed at the restaurant with my friends the whole time and then I went straight home from there. I didn't tell him I went to see Carrie on the way home.
Okay. Sunday morning, you wake up. I understand your parents left early to play golf. You mowed the lawn until the detective came and you went with him to Hackensack. Did you go anywhere or talk to anyone after you got back from Hackensack and before your parents got home?
Alan was silent for a moment. Parker put down his pen and said gently,
Alan, the only way I can effectively help you is if you are honest with me.
When I got back from Hackensack, I was freaking out. I needed somebody to back up my story that I went straight home from Nellie's.
So what did you do?
I called one of the guys I was with. The other two guys were at his house. I asked them to back me up that I stayed at Nellie's as late as they did.
Do you know if they've spoken to the police?
Yes, they have.
Okay.
Alan gave Parker the names of his three friends and their contact information. Alan said,
Look, I know I panicked and I screwed up, and I know that by lying I've made it worse. What can I do to start making things right?
Parker looked directly at his client.
There are two things you can do. From now on, aside from your parents and me, talk to no one about the case. If anyone contacts you, refer him to me.
Alan nodded.
The other thing you can do is when you go home, tell your parents what you just told me. They're going to find out anyway, so let's get that difficult discussion behind us right away.
In the morning at breakfast, Steve announced that he was coming home early and he and Fran were going to the movies. Fran had not yet come down from their room. Over a quick second cup of coffee, he said to Aline,
I think I need to get your mother out of the house. I told her that last night after Detective Wilson left, and she agreed. She's so fixated on the idea that Alan Crowley murdered Carrie that she's telling that to everybody she speaks to. I told her that until there is real proof, we have to keep an open mind. But even after all that Detective Wilson told us about the man who sold Carrie the beer, she is still fixated on Alan's guilt.
Steve carried his empty coffee mug over and placed it in the sink.
One night every week, a theater in Norwood is running the old classics. Greer Garson is still one of your mother's favorite actors. She'll enjoy seeing Random Harvest on the big screen. It starts at 5 o'clock, and then I'll take her out to dinner. Do you want to join us for the movie, dinner, or both?
Thanks, Dad, but I'll pass. I want to catch up on some stuff at school. I'll pick up something for dinner on the way home.
The next day at school was a little easier than the one before. Aline had always been good at remembering names and faces. After she passed one of the students in the hallway, she remembered that she had seen her before and where it was. This was the girl who had been standing across the street from the church when the mass for Carrie was over.
I wonder why she didn't come in, Aline asked herself.
She was in her office until 6. She had left her door partially open and Scott Kimball looked in.
Obviously working late again, he said.
A little, Aline replied.
Is there any chance that when you're ready to wrap up, you'll have dinner with me? I know I asked you only yesterday, but the question just popped into my head. You know, it might be a nice change.
Are you tempting me with the French restaurant you were talking about?
Absolutely.
Then my answer is, oui.
They laughed together. Aline declined Scott's offer to ride with him and instead took her own car to La Petite restaurant. Scott had told her he lived in Fort Lee. Driving her back to pick up her car at school would take him way out of his way. On the way over, she started to have second thoughts. She berated herself for agreeing to go to dinner with him. She went over in her head why it was foolish to alter the business relationship of two faculty members who worked in the same school.
Just this once, she told herself. Absolutely just this once.
She began to relax at the restaurant. La Petite turned out to be every bit as good as Scott had promised. In the 3 years she had taught at the International School in London, it had been easy to take the train through the Channel to Paris. It was a trip she had made every few months while she lived in England. She would stay at a small hotel on the left bank that overlooked Notre Dame Cathedral. She made regular visits to the Louvre and other museums, as well as boat trips on the Seine. Along the way, she had developed a passion for French food. At the same time, she had perfected her natural gift for languages. Her goal was to become fluent in French and to speak it without an American accent. When their waiter introduced himself with a French accent, she saw an opportunity to practice. Scott then surprised her by following her lead. His command of French was very good, but his American accent was clearly discernible. After listening to the specials, they gave their orders. As they sipped the Bordeaux Scott had chosen, he said,
I took a semester in France when I was in college. It was a program where I took courses in French and lived with a French family.
Total immersion? Aline asked.
That was the idea, Scott chuckled. But when I was with the other students, it was really easy to slip back to speaking English.
I wish I had had an opportunity like that, Aline said.
Whatever you did, your French is better than mine.
There's a reason for that.
She told him about her frequent trips to Paris. They compared notes on different places they had visited in and around Paris. The conversation shifted to the high school, and Scott shared his impressions of his fellow teachers and the administration. It was only over coffee that he brought up Carrie's name.
Aline, I've had a wonderful time tonight. Part of me wants to tell you about how great a young woman Carrie was, but I'm reluctant to introduce a topic that might upset you.
No, it's okay. I saw Carrie through the eyes of a big sister. If I had it to do over again, I would not have been away as much as I was the last 3 years. What was it like to be her coach?
She was really special. She wasn't the best player on the team, but she was very good, and she had a natural ability to lead. The best compliment you can give a player is that she made her teammates better when she was on the field.
When the evening ended and she was driving home, Aline realized that she had enjoyed the dinner very much. Scott was a very nice guy, and he was good company. 27. The results of the autopsy revealed that Carrie had been killed instantly by a massive blow to the back of her skull. There was almost no water in her lungs, indicating she had not been breathing after being struck. The alcohol level in her blood was 0.06, the equivalent of a person her size consuming 2 to 3 drinks. There was no evidence of sexual assault. The state lab's analysis of the golf club verified that it was the weapon that had been used on Carrie. The strands of hair on the head of the putter were matched with samples of her hair. The specks of blood lifted from the club contained Carrie's DNA. Fingerprints on the rubber grip would be virtually impossible to collect, but there were 5 identifiable prints on the shaft that potentially could be matched. Mike began the process of identifying the prints by going first to Steve and Fran Dowling. It was, as he had expected, a difficult meeting. Once again, he swung by at about 6:45 p.m. when Steve would be home. When he explained his reason for being there, it caused Fran to cry out in near hysteria.
"Are you telling me that our golf club was used to kill my little girl?"
"Fran, Detective Wilson is telling us that he needs to identify whose fingerprints are on the club. Obviously, he wants to know which are ours and eliminate them. You can have them taken at the Saddle River Police Station," Mike said. "They'll forward them to the prosecutor's office."
"We'll go there tomorrow morning," Steve assured him.
Aline put her arm around her mother.
"Mom, we all want to see whoever hurt Carrie get caught."
Fran repeated what she had said before.
"It was Alan Crowley."
Turning to Wilson, she said, "Do you have his fingerprints?"
"Yes, but let's wait for the total fingerprint analysis to be complete."
Aline again walked him to the door.
"Mike, I've been thinking and thinking about that text Carrie sent me the day before her party. I say this with love. Carrie had a little bit of the drama queen in her. Whether it was a quarrel with a boyfriend or a dispute with a teacher, she always quickly said what was on her mind. In the text she sent the day before the party, she referred to something very important, but didn't say what it was. That's not the way Carrie usually did things."
"Aline," Mike said, "I know how hard all this is for you, but I can see that you are a great comfort to your parents."
His hand brushed hers as she opened the door for him.
"Aline, I promise you and your mother and father that we are going to find out who did this to Carrie and your family, and that person will go away for a very long time.
At that time, maybe we'll be able to try and put our lives back together," Aline said.
But there was doubt in her voice. 28. Bobby, Rich, and Stan had collective guilt after lying for Alan. The detective had interviewed them one at a time, and each of them stuck to the story.
"Alan got to Nellie's about 10:30 and left at the same time we did, about 11:45.
Rich even shared that Alan told them that he was going to see Carrie in the morning and make up with her. Stan told Mike Wilson that Alan had been mad when he came to Nellie's, but he got over it. Bobby volunteered that Alan had said that Carrie liked to tease him because she enjoyed making up. When Mike asked them if they knew who sold the beer to Carrie, they claimed truthfully that they had no idea. But after they spoke to Mike, They got together and discussed the possibility that Alan might break down and admit that he had left Nellie's early, gone back, and killed Carrie. If Alan did that, what would happen to them? Would they end up in jail for lying? The three of them, together and individually, worried about that. They tried to reassure one another, but they still had visions of getting arrested and going to jail. Aline was sure she knew why Marge had not brought Jamie to the funeral mass. From the time Jamie was born, the Chapmans and the Dowlings had been very cordial. Carrie had been Jamie's lifelong friend. How hard it must be for him to comprehend that she's gone forever, Aline thought. Steve had put in the pool when Carrie was 10. Jamie always wanted to swim in it if Carrie was there. If he was out in the yard, Carrie would call Marge and ask if he could come over to swim. He followed Carrie's every movement in the pool and became a very adequate swimmer himself. Aline always knew how much he adored Carrie and how much he would miss her now. When the company came in to close the pool for the winter, she noticed Jamie watching them from his side of the hedge that separated the backyards. Impulsively, she walked over and spoke to him.
"Jamie, how are you?"
she asked.
"I'm sad."
"Why are you sad, Jamie?"
"Because Carrie went swimming and then to heaven."
"I know, Jamie. I'm sad, too."
"My daddy went to heaven, so Carrie is with him."
Jamie's eyes were filling with tears. Aline felt herself on the verge of breaking down. She didn't want to do that in front of him. She said,
"I'll see you soon, Jamie,"
and went back into the house. 30. Mike Wilson decided that his next move would be to go to Nellie's and verify the time that Alan and his friends had been there and when they left. He phoned the restaurant and was told by the manager that the same wait staff that had been on duty Saturday would be there this evening. It turned out to be easy to find the waitress he wanted to speak to. Glady Moore had been telling everyone that she had served Alan Crowley the night that poor girl was murdered. Wilson got to the restaurant at 7, spoke to Glady briefly, and was told she could take time to talk to him in about 15 minutes. The tempting smell of pizza reminded him that he was hungry. He ordered a margarita pizza and a glass of beer. As she had promised, Glady came over to his table and sat opposite him.
"Carrie used to come in here with her friends," she said. "She was such a beautiful girl. To think that she was murdered the very night that I was serving pizza to those boys."
"Do you remember what time they got to the restaurant?"
"Three of them, not the boyfriend, Alan Crowley, came in around 10 o'clock. The Yankees were playing, so they took a table near the bar so they could watch the game."
"When did Alan join them?" Mike asked.
"It was about 10:30. You should have seen the look on his face."
"What do you mean by that?" Mike asked.
"He looked so angry. You'd think he wanted to kill somebody. He was so rude to me. He didn't ask for anything, just pointed to the pizza the other boys were eating, indicating that's what he wanted. Just between you and me, I think he avoided talking because he had been drinking. When I brought his order, he was texting on his cell phone."
"Okay,"
Mike said.
"He arrived at 10:30. Let's say you took his order at 10:35. How long does it take to make the pizza?"
"About 10 minutes."
"So you brought him his order at 10:45. What happened next?"
"When he finished it, he just walked out without paying."
"If you can remember, what time was that?"
"Let's see. He talked to the boys for a while. I noticed he was on his phone texting some more."
"What time do you think it was when he left?"
"I know it was a little after 11, not later than 11:15.
"Let's focus on his three friends. Do you remember what time they left?"
"They stayed until the end of the game."
Mike had checked. The game had ended at 11:46.
"Thank you, Glady. You've been very helpful. I may ask you at a later date to come down to my office and give an official statement."
A delighted smile came over Glady's face.
"I'd love to. I can make it any time you want."
As Mike was getting up to leave, he asked,
"Did you ever get paid for Alan's pizza?"
"One of his friends took care of it."
Mike went to the prosecutor's office, where Assistant Prosecutor Artie Shulman was waiting for him. Artie was the chief of the homicide unit.
"Artie, can we talk in my office?"
he asked.
"It will be easier."
On his wall, Mike had a series of whiteboards. The first showed in alphabetical order the names of the kids who had been at Carrie's party. Most of the names were written in black. The seven names written in red were under 18 years old. To the left of each name was the date Mike or a member of his team had questioned the student, or a big R. R, Mike explained, meant they refused to be interviewed, or if they were minors, their parents had refused the interview. Eight names were preceded by an R. To the right of each name was a date in August or September. It was the date of the student's departure for his or her respective college. On the second whiteboard, there were eight names. These were students who claimed they had witnessed the argument that took place between Alan and Carrie at the party. A T to the right of their names indicated the girls who had sent a text message to Carrie after the party. The third whiteboard listed the names of Alan Crowley's three supposed alibi witnesses. Artie looked at the whiteboards.
"Two of the students who witnessed the arguments are headed for schools in the Midwest, and another is going to California,"
Mike said.
"I'm assuming that for budget reasons, Matt Koenig will want me to complete these interviews in New Jersey versus flying across the country,"
he added, referring to the county prosecutor.
"You've got that right," Artie agreed.
Mike updated him on the progress of his investigation.
"We got the court order to go through Alan Crowley's cell phone records. He is lying about how long he stayed at the restaurant. His phone pinged a tower right by the victim's home on the other side of Saddle River at 11:25 p.m. It's pretty clear he went back to the victim's home after he left Nellie's."
"What about Crowley's friends who gave him an alibi?"
"It looks like he asked them to lie for him, and they did. I'm going to contact the three of them and have them come down here to give a formal statement. After I read them the Riot Act about what could happen when you lie to an investigator, I'm sure their memories will improve."
"We've confirmed the golf club was the murder weapon," Shulman said. "Any progress on identifying the fingerprints on it?"
"Yes, but that's going to be a problem," Mike told him.
"Why?"
Mike picked up a report on his desk and flipped the page.
"According to the lab, there are five separate identifiable prints on the putter. All of these are on the steel shaft. The numerous prints on the rubber grip are so smudged that they're unusable."
"Anything on the putter head?"
"No."
"So where does that leave us?"
"Alan Crowley's thumbprint is on the putter. The victim's parents, the Dowlings, gave us their prints. Each has one fingerprint on the putter. That leaves two we still have to match."
"Where do we go from there?"
"That is the problem. In my interviews of the party guests, a number of them who spent time outside in the backyard either admitted to using the practice green or gave me the names of boys who were taking turns putting."
"So we have a lot of kids who actually handled the murder weapon?"
"Correct. Of the eight males who I can identify as having handled the putter, not a single one has a criminal record."
"And therefore we don't have their prints on file?"
"Even though most of the students who were at the party consented to be interviewed, I'm pretty sure we'll get a lot of resistance if we ask them to give fingerprints."
Artie nodded.
"We can't ask a judge to compel them to give us their prints because they aren't suspects."
"That's right."
"Have you been able to pin down the time of death?"
Artie asked.
"The medical examiner's report didn't give us much help there. The pool water was 85 degrees. In water that warm, body tissue degrades quickly. The latest we know she was alive was 11:10 p.m. on Saturday when she sent her last text. The family found her in the water at 11:15 a.m. on Sunday. So the maximum amount of time she was in the water is about 12 hours.
"So she could have been killed at 4 in the morning?"
"Yes, but that's highly unlikely. Alan Crowley, in his statement, said she was going to clean up outside and then go to bed. Her text to him says the same thing. I was at the property. In another 10 minutes, she could have finished cleaning the backyard."
"So there's no evidence to suggest that she might have gone to bed and then Crowley forced her to come back outside?"
"No, there isn't. But there is evidence that she never went to bed that night. We checked her room. Her bed was made."
"That doesn't tell us much. For all we know, she went to sleep on the couch."
"Agreed. but the autopsy showed that at the time of her death, she still had her contact lenses in.
People forget to take them out, particularly if they've been drinking.
I spoke to the victim's sister. According to her, Carrie never would have forgotten. One time she left them in overnight and got a serious eye infection. She was religious about taking them out before going to sleep.
So what time do you think the murder took place?
Between 11:10, when she sent her last text, and about 10 minutes later, when she would have finished cleaning the backyard.
Precisely the time Crowley came back to the house.
Artie, I believe that subject to interviewing Crowley's friends who were at Nellie's and confirming that they lied, we have more than enough to arrest Alan Crowley. He was at the party, he was jealous, he sent angry text messages to her. Phone records show that he went back to the home to see her after the party and lied about it. He asked his friends to lie. His fingerprints are on the murder weapon. He denied having touched it the night of the party.
Where are we on this Good Samaritan flat tire changer?
Carrie's friend said Carrie told her that after she picked up the beer, he was aggressive and tried to kiss her. But a couple of her friends say she was a flirt. Maybe she was exaggerating. She was a very pretty young woman. As of today, we've made almost no progress in trying to find him.
I wish we could have nailed that down, but everything really seems to point to Crowley.
And we can't talk to Crowley any further because Lester Parker won't allow us.
All right. Get back to me after you question his three friends. How soon can you talk to them?
Wilson checked his whiteboard.
One of them is taking a term off. Two of them are in college locally and have agreed to come back. They're coming in to talk to me this afternoon.
Bobby, Stan, and Rich each received the phone call they dreaded. Detective Mike Wilson told them that the information they had given when they first spoke to him was very important to the investigation. He wanted them to come down to Hackensack and give formal statements. All three had agreed to go to the prosecutor's office together at 4:30 that afternoon. Mike took them into the interrogation room. Normally, he interviewed witnesses separately, but he thought it would be more effective to challenge the three of them together. All of them had sweating palms as they sat in the three chairs on one side of the conference table. He turned the video camera on. Mike began gently.
Alan is your friend, right? You played baseball together.
They all nodded.
It is very natural for friends to want to help a friend that might be in trouble. I've done it myself. I'm convinced that is what each of you did the last time I spoke to you. Well, things are different today. I know a lot more about what happened that night and who was where at what time. So I'm going to ask you questions. This is your chance to put things right. If you lie to me today, you will be charged with false swearing and obstruction of justice.
Mike paused.
And possibly accessory to murder. Now let's get started.
Words tumbled out of the mouths of all three of them.
Alan left Nellie's before we did. We didn't know we'd be in trouble. When Alan phoned, he sounded so scared. The minute we lied for him, we knew we were making a mistake.
Mike said,
okay, hold on. What time did Alan leave Nellie's?
Desperate to be exact, the three of them agreed it was about 11:15. Mike asked,
did he say anything about where he was going?
Stan answered,
Carrie had sent him a text telling him not to come over until tomorrow. But he said he wanted to straighten things out that night.
Mike said,
so it was your impression that he was leaving Nellie's and going directly to Carrie's?
Yes.
When Alan joined you at Nellie's, can you tell me if he had been drinking?
There was a moment of silence. Then all three nodded.
A little? A lot? How much?
He was kinda drunk when he got to Nellie's, but after he had the pizza and soda, he was pretty okay,
Rich said. The three affirmed that they were together at Stan's pool that Sunday afternoon when Alan phoned and asked them to lie for him.
I thank you for coming here today. You did the right thing by telling us the truth.
Watching them leave, Mike thought that nobody had ever been happier to get out of there than these three. He went back to his office and called Artie. They agreed that it was time to arrest Alan Crowley. 32. June and Doug Crowley felt somewhat relieved after their meeting with Lester Parker. They drove directly home with Alan. When they were inside, June went into the den and settled there with a satisfied sigh. Doug and Alan followed her in.
"Lester Parker may be expensive, but I believe he's worth it," June observed.
Her expression changed.
"Fran Dowling is telling everyone that you killed Carrie," she said, looking at Alan. "I'm going to have Parker write a stiff letter to her, saying that we are going to sue her if she continues her malicious defamation."
"I agree," Doug said heartily.
They both looked at Alan, expecting his approval.
"Mom, Dad, there's something I have to tell you."
"Oh my God, he's going to tell us he killed her," June thought, her blood running cold.
"I wasn't honest with you or the detective in Hackensack about where I was after I left the party. I did go to Nellie's, but on my way home, I went to Carrie's house."
"Alan, don't tell us you killed her," June begged.
A suddenly white-faced Doug gripped the arms of the chair, preparing for the worst.
"I killed her? That's what you two have believed all along," Alan snapped. "Here's what really happened. I went back to make up with Carrie and help her clean up. We spoke for a few minutes. She told me she was tired and going to bed. She said she would get up early in the morning to clean up. I kissed her goodnight and came straight home."
"Then why did you lie to the detective?" Doug asked.
"Because I knew it would look bad for me. We had a fight at the party and everybody saw it. I sent her some nasty text messages which I'm sure the cops know about. If I admitted going back to her house, I was afraid how that would look."
"Alan," June said, "you know your father and I are behind you no matter what."
"No matter what? What does that mean? You're behind me even if I killed her?"
Alan stood up.
"Well, you might as well know I not only lied to the detective, I asked my friends to lie and say I was at Nellie's with them when I was really at Carrie's."
Doug and June were too stunned to react. Alan looked at his mother.
"You better not send that letter to Mrs. Dowling," he said bitterly, and stalked out of the room.
Brenda was in the kitchen when she heard raised voices coming from the den. Knowing every inch of the house and blessed with exceptionally good hearing, she knew exactly where to go when she wanted to listen to Crowley conversations. She tiptoed from the kitchen down the hall and ducked into the small bathroom next to the den. She brought a roll of paper towels and a bottle of Windex in case she had to look busy. The words, "he lied to the detective," swirled around in her brain. Always sympathetic to Alan because of the Crowley's demands on him, she began to wonder.
Why would he have lied to the cops? There's no way he would hurt Carrie.
She couldn't wait to get over to talk to Marge after she finished preparing dinner for the Crowleys. She was glad to see Marge's car as she drove up her street. When Marge answered the door and invited her in, she pointed up the stairs.
"Brenda, Jamie's having a really bad day. He's been crying because he misses Carrie," she said, her tone weary.
"Oh, Marge, I'm so sorry."
"It happens every few days. He misses her so much. I think losing Carrie is bringing back his sadness from when Jack died."
"Of course. He misses Carrie and his father," Brenda said sympathetically. "But wait till you hear the latest."
She waited until they were seated at the kitchen table and Marge had put on the kettle for a cup of tea.
"Marge,"
Brenda began,
"you won't believe me when I tell you what Alan told the Crowleys."
34. At 6:45 the next morning, Fran and Steve were awakened by the ringing of the bedside phone. Fran groped for it and sat up straight. It was Mike Wilson telling her that they were on their way to arrest Alan Crowley for Carrie's murder. He would be brought to the Bergen County Jail in Hackensack today and would be arraigned in the next couple days. The arraignment before the judge would be open to the public, and the Dowlings could attend. Mike added,
"Mrs. Dowling will be there in a few minutes. Do not share this information until I've called you back to confirm that Alan was at his house and is in our custody."
Fran replaced the phone and said,
Steve, fantastic news. It's just as I've been saying. Alan Crowley is being arrested today for killing Carrie.
15 minutes later, June and Doug Crowley were startled awake by persistent pounding on their front door and the ringing of the doorbell. Instinctively suspecting that the reason for the abrupt intrusion was going to be a problem, June grabbed her robe and raced downstairs. She yanked open the door and saw two men in plain clothes side by side with a uniformed policeman. She had no way of knowing that another uniformed officer was in the backyard to guard against the possibility that Alan would try to escape.
Ma'am, I'm Detective Wilson from the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office. We have a warrant for the arrest of Alan Crowley and a search warrant for the premises, he told her. Is he here at this time?
My son is represented by counsel, by Lester Parker. Have you spoken to him?
Your son has the right to speak to his attorney later. We are here now to arrest him.
Without being asked, Wilson pushed open the door and stepped past June Crowley into the house. His fellow detective and the officer followed him. By this time, Doug and Alan were tumbling down the stairs in time to hear the word, arrest. Alan gripped his father's arm as the words sank in. He was dressed in only a t-shirt and boxers. He looked at Mike Wilson.
Can I at least get dressed?
Wilson answered Alan's question.
Yes, you can get dressed. We'll follow you to your room.
He and the other detective climbed the stairs behind Alan and walked down the hallway to his room. Two partially packed suitcases were on the floor by the window. Next to them was an unzipped Nike sports bag with several wooden bats and two baseball gloves inside.
Are you going someplace, Alan?
Mike asked, although he already knew the answer.
I'm leaving for college the day after tomorrow, Alan said. Can I still go? Let's see how today goes,
Mike said matter-of-factly. He watched as Alan went into his closet and pulled out jeans and a pair of running shoes.
Sorry, Alan. No shoelaces, no belt, and no jewelry.
In her bedroom, June was frantically dialing Lester Parker's office. Filled with frustration at being connected to a recording, she shrieked,
"This is June Crowley! The police are here with a warrant for Alan's arrest! Call me on my cell phone at once!"
She reached into her closet and grabbed a running suit. Doug was quickly pulling on a pair of pants and shirt. They managed to be back downstairs as Alan, a detective on each side of him, was walking out the front door toward the waiting cars.
"Where are you taking him?"
June shouted. She gasped as she noticed for the first time that Alan's hands were cuffed behind his back. Mike answered,
"To the Bergen County Jail in Hackensack."
June saw two of her neighbors standing in their driveways, observing the scene that was unfolding before them.
"Can one of us ride with Alan?"
she yelled to Mike Wilson.
"No, but you can follow us to the jail."
June jogged to catch up to them. She grabbed Alan's arm as Wilson was opening the back door of his unmarked car.
"Alan, I phoned Lester Parker. He's going to get right back to me. Remember what he told you. Don't answer any questions unless he is with you."
There were tears in Alan's eyes. Before he had a chance to answer her, he felt Wilson's hand on his head, firmly forcing it down as he slid through the opened door. There was a wire grill separating the front and back seats. June maintained eye contact with Alan for as long as she could as the car began to slowly back down her driveway. As she watched Wilson drive away, her normally steely resolve melted.
"My baby! Oh my God, my baby!"
she sobbed as Doug put his arm around her and helped her toward his car. After turning off Hollywood Avenue, the detective's car accelerated onto Route 17. The traffic was moving quickly as they were a little ahead of the worst part of the morning rush. A bewildered Alan tried to make sense of what was going on around him. Only days ago, he had ridden in this same car with Detective Wilson to Hackensack. But on the earlier trip, he had been in the front seat and was not wearing handcuffs. He found himself hoping that this was one long nightmare. When he woke up, he would go to Carrie's house, make up with her, and hurry home to mow the lawn, and finish organizing what he would bring to college. It didn't work. This was real. Wilson and the other detective made no attempt to speak to him. He could hear them talking about the monstrously long home run the Yankees' Aaron Judge had hit the previous evening. He had seen it.
"For them, this is just another day at the office," he thought. "For me, my life is over."
Processing at the jail was a blur. The bright flashes as he was photographed straight on and in profile. Being fingerprinted again. Answering a barrage of questions. Alan was taken into a windowless room. His handcuffs were removed. He was given a bag and told to take off his clothes and put them in it. He assumed it would be okay to keep his underwear on. He was told to put on an orange jumpsuit that was on the counter in front of him. After changing, he was taken to a community holding cell. About a dozen people were there. There were benches along the walls of the room and one in the center. Toward the back of the cell on the right, in full view of all, was a stainless steel toilet. No one was sitting on the bench closest to it. Alan took a seat on a bench near the cell door. About half the people in the cell appeared to be around his age or a little older. One prisoner sitting by himself in the corner smelled to high heaven. Everybody was sitting, mostly with their heads down. There were a few conversations going on. A loudmouth was sharing his experiences with someone who had never been arrested. Alan heard another one explaining the difference between jail and prison. "If you incarcerated for up to 364 days, you in jail. 365 days or more, you in prison." Alan had not eaten breakfast and was very hungry. He made eye contact with a middle-aged man on the bench opposite him.
"Is food something you ask for, or do they bring it when they're ready?"
The man smiled.
"They just bring it. But believe me, it's nothing you'd ask for."
There was no clock that he could see, and watches weren't permitted. After what he thought was several hours, a guard began unlocking the cell door. Behind the guard was an older man pushing a cart with numerous paper bags on the top tray. Alan was handed a brown paper bag. Inside was something wrapped in wax paper. He put it on his lap and opened it. The thickness of the stale roll covered the two slices of bologna deep inside. He assumed the gooey white substance was mayonnaise. The man opposite him had seen the expression on his face.
"I guess they were out of filet mignon," he said as he bit into his sandwich.
Fearful that dinner would not be any better, Alan forced himself to eat half of it. Also in the bag, compliments of the state of New Jersey, was a plastic bottle of water. He was later moved to the commons area in the general population. About 20 inmates were seated on folding chairs watching CNN. Small groups were off to the sides playing chess, checkers, and cards.
"Recreation time," Alan thought bitterly.
In the late afternoon, they were marched into what passed for a dining room. He followed the lead of others who took a tray and a plate and walked past the servers who put scoops on their plates. The utensils were plastic. He spotted a half-filled table where the inmates appeared to be near his age. They were exchanging stories about why they had been arrested. Two of them had been caught with heroin. Another was serving a drunk driving sentence, his third. They looked at him, obviously expecting to hear his story.
"My girlfriend died in an accident. They're blaming me."
"Which judge you got?"
"I don't know."
After dinner, they were herded back to the community room. One of the inmates who had been at the dinner table asked Alan,
"You play chess?"
"Yeah, I do,"
he said as he followed the other prisoner to a table. In the time he had been in the jail, it was the only hour that passed relatively quickly. A few minutes after the game ended, the prisoners stood up and formed a queue along the wall.
"Back to the cells," Alan's chess opponent announced. "See you tomorrow."
The guard unlocked a cell and directed him into it. There were bunk beds along the left wall. A stainless steel toilet was in the right corner. A very small window overlooked the parking area behind the courthouse. A man who appeared to be in his 30s in the lower bunk glanced at him as he came in, but then went back to whatever he was reading. Alan wanted to find out where he could get something to read, but he was too nervous to ask. The top bunk was his, but Alan was uncertain about what to do. There was no ladder. In order to hoist himself up, he would have to put one foot on the lower bunk.
Should I ask permission, or just do it? Better not to disturb him,
Alan thought, as he put a foot on the lower end of the bottom bunk and vaulted himself to the top. He waited apprehensively for a protest from below. There was none. The mattress was thin and lumpy. The blanket and sheet had a strong smell of disinfectant. Alan put his hands behind his head on the small pillow and stared at the ceiling. It was several hours before he fell asleep. It was a challenge to tune out the loud snoring emanating from the bunk beneath him. He was startled awake by the sound of voices, footsteps, and cell doors sliding open. Following a line of prisoners, he went to the same room where he had had dinner the previous evening, this time for breakfast. He had just followed the procession to the recreation room when a guard barked,
"Alan Crowley!"
Alan meekly raised his hand.
"Let's go,"
the guard said, gesturing him to follow. He was led down a long corridor with doors on each side. Above each door was a plate that read, "Attorney-Client Room," followed by a number. The guard opened the door to number 7. Alan spotted Lester Parker seated at the table, with his briefcase next to him. He took a chair opposite him.
"Alan, how are you doing?"
Parker said as they shook hands.
"I'm undefeated in chess,"
Alan said wryly. Parker smiled.
"I've spoken to the assistant prosecutor. We went over the charges against you. They'll bring you into court tomorrow at 11. I'll be there."
"After court tomorrow, will I be getting out of here?"
"I can't say with certainty what's going to happen tomorrow, but I'm going to make a strong argument that you be allowed to go home."
"Will my parents be there? In court?"
"Yes, and they want you home just as much as you want to go home. I'll see you tomorrow. And remember, talk to no one about your case."
35. Word of Alan Crowley's arrest had begun to spread in the afternoon. Aline saw students in their breaks between classes, at their lockers, staring down at their phones. NorthJersey.com had been the first to report the story. She picked up her phone, but then decided against calling her mother. When she drove up the driveway a few minutes before 6 that evening, Steve pulled in right behind her. When they were both out of their cars, she said,
"I am sure that Alan's arrest will be on the television news tonight."
Steve nodded.
"Yes, I was thinking the same thing."
As he opened the front door, Steve called,
"Fran?"
"In here."
Steve and Aline went to the den, where Fran had the TV on Channel 2. They watched in silence as the segment that had been on the 5 o'clock news was repeated. Steve moved quickly to where Fran was sitting and put his arm around her.
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"Yes," she said. "In fact, I'm..."
She paused.
"Glad is not the right word. I'll never have real peace, but when Alan goes to prison, I'll have some sense that justice has been served."
"Mom," Aline said, "remember, Alan's only been accused of the crime. That doesn't mean..." Steve interrupted her.
"They usually don't arrest somebody until they've got the right guy and have enough to convict him."
"Aline, why are you defending him?" Fran snapped. "He killed your sister and then he lied about it."
"Mom, Dad, please," Aline said. "I'm not trying to start a fight." When Carrie and Alan were going out, they were constantly quarreling, breaking up, and then getting back together. They repeated that cycle a bunch of times. But after they quarrel at Carrie's party, this time he comes back to the house and kills her? I don't know, it just doesn't add up.
"What doesn't add up?" Fran said heatedly. "You know he lied about coming back to the house after the party."
"I understand that, but listen to me. Kids who are barely 18 are incredibly insecure. I work with them every day. They think they're adults, but they're not.
When you confront them, they look for the easy way out, even if that means lying,"
Aline said, her voice rising.
"I'd be really nervous if a cop showed up today and took me in for questioning. I can only imagine how panicky I would have been 10 years ago when I was 18.
Fran was having none of it.
"You can rationalize this as much as you want. I don't care if he was a scared young kid. Alan Crowley killed Carrie and he's going to pay for it."
"Fran, Aline," Steve interrupted.
The last thing we need to do is quarrel with each other. The truth will come out at the trial.
Fran had the last word.
At the trial, when he's found guilty, you mean?
Thirty-six. Alan was taken from the jail and escorted into the adjacent courthouse, where he appeared before a judge at about 11:30 a.m. The guards seated him next to a waiting Lester Parker. His parents sat on one side of the courtroom, in the first row of the spectator seats. His mother gasped when she saw him in the orange jumpsuit. This time his hands were cuffed in front of him. On the other side of the courtroom, in the front row, were Fran and Steve Dowling. When they made eye contact with him, he turned away. The assistant prosecutor read the charges against him. Murder, possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose, the golf club, and tampering with witnesses. The judge, a balding man with glasses pushed high on his forehead, turned to Lester Parker.
Counsel, how does your client plead?
Not guilty, Your Honor.
Turning to the assistant prosecutor, the judge stated,
Your office has moved to detain the defendant pending trial.
The assistant prosecutor began,
Your Honor, the state has a very strong case against Alan Crowley. Our investigation has revealed that he attended a party at the home of Carrie Dowling the night of her death and became extremely jealous when another young man spoke to her. We allege that later in the evening, after everyone else was gone, he returned and struck her in the back of the head with a golf club. She fell into the pool in the backyard of her home. Her family discovered her body in the pool the next morning. He lied to a detective regarding his whereabouts at the time of the crime and induced several friends to lie on his behalf. They have since admitted that they lied. He also lied about handling the golf club that evening, but it has his fingerprint on it.
The assistant prosecutor continued,
Your Honor, we are seriously concerned about the risk of flight if he were released. He faces life in prison. He has already tampered with witnesses and could seek to do so again.
Alan lowered his head and closed his eyes as he listened to the evil picture painted of him.
Parker's response was loud and forceful. Your Honor, my client has no record of any kind. He hasn't even had a traffic ticket. He has no history whatsoever of violence. He has lived in the same house in Saddle River with his parents since he was born. He is their only child. He graduated from high school 3 months ago and is scheduled to begin college at Princeton within a few days. He has absolutely no resources of his own.
Parker continued,
Your Honor, I have been provided with some of the investigative reports. The prosecutor failed to mention that there were no witnesses to the crime. He also failed to mention that there are at least two other unidentified fingerprints on the golf club. One of those fingerprints may belong to the perpetrator of this terrible crime. The reports also indicate that Carrie had had an encounter with a young man who had very recently stopped to help her change a flat tire. The victim told friends that this young man had bought the alcohol for her party, but had become angry and aggressive with her when she declined his request to be invited to the party. This person has never been identified, but should be considered a person of considerable interest in this investigation. Your Honor, we no longer have a bail system. You either detain the defendant or you don't. It would be a travesty for him to spend a year or more in jail awaiting trial. We intend to vigorously defend against these charges. The state has no basis whatsoever for considering him to be a threat to anyone in the community or a flight risk.
Solemnly, the judge reflected upon the arguments.
This is a difficult decision. The defendant is charged with a heinous crime. I consider most carefully the prosecutor's arguments in support of detention. But defense counsel has also offered strong arguments. The defendant is 18 years old. I do not believe he is a strong risk of flight. There is no evidence that he represents a threat to any specific person in the community. Counsel has argued that there are no witnesses to this crime and the evidence is circumstantial. Under all of these circumstances, I am entering the following order. The defendant is released under the following conditions. He is to wear an electronic monitoring bracelet at all times. He may not leave the state of New Jersey without the permission of this court. He is to live at his parents' Saddle River address unless he is at college, which I note is in the state of New Jersey.
He is to have no contact with the victim's family. The defendant shall be taken back to the Bergen County Jail, where he will be fitted with the electronic bracelet and thereafter be released.
Alan's shoulders visibly slumped in relief. Parker put his arm on his shoulder and whispered,
"Okay, Alan, go home and get some rest. I will call you tomorrow. Remember, aside from your parents, talk to no one about your case."
To avoid an encounter between the families, the sheriff's department allowed the Dowling family to leave first. Once they were on the elevator, the Crowleys got up to go. Chapter 37. A distraught and angry June Crowley drove home with Doug and Alan. It had taken nearly 2 hours after the arraignment to have Alan returned to the Bergen County Jail and then processed out. On the way to Saddle River, Alan closed his eyes as though he were asleep. There was zero conversation during the 25-minute ride. They were all hungry. Doug and June had barely had any breakfast, and except for cups of coffee at the courthouse, they hadn't eaten since early morning. Alan had been so nervous before the arraignment that he hadn't eaten a bite of the jail breakfast. Together they walked into the kitchen and were glad to see that Brenda had an early dinner prepared. As usual, she had the small kitchen TV on while she worked. They all froze when they heard the name Crowley and looked up at the set. On screen was Alan, handcuffed and in the orange jumpsuit, being led into the courthouse. The reporter was saying, "Alan Crowley, the boyfriend of murdered teen Carrie Dowling, was in court this morning. He was arraigned before Judge Paul Martinez on charges of murder, possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose, and witness tampering. He pleaded not guilty. After being fitted with an electronic bracelet, he was released into the custody of his parents. June Crowley, the mother of the accused, spoke to me on camera after the arraignment. There is no way in the world my son committed this crime. He loved Carrie. The only reason he went back to her house the night of her party was to help her clean up and make sure she was all right. The police scared the hell out of a kid who had just turned 18. They snatched him from our home on a Sunday morning when my husband and I were not home, drove him to the prosecutor's office, interrogated him, and intimidated him into lying. And now they're saying because he lied, he must have killed her." She was interrupted by a visibly annoyed Lester Parker, who took June's arm and physically moved her away from the microphone. He stated firmly,
"A vigorous defense will be mounted on behalf of Alan Crowley. When all the facts are known, he will be vindicated. There will be no further statements from the Crowleys before the trial."
An awkward silence followed when the news station moved on to the next story. Brenda said,
"The meatloaf, vegetables, and potatoes just need to be warmed."
She gave Alan a sympathetic smile.
"I'll let you eat in peace," she said,
as she hurried toward the door. 38. Marge and Jamie were having dinner in the kitchen when Marge turned on the television to get the 6 o'clock news. The lead story was the arraignment of Alan Crowley. She watched as Alan, pale and tense, left the courthouse with photographers and reporters chasing after him.
"That's Alan Crowley," Jamie said.
"I didn't know you knew Alan," Marge said.
"He's Carrie's friend, before she went to heaven."
"Yes, he is."
"He kisses her."
"Yes, he does," Marge said.
"He kissed her before she went swimming and went to heaven."
"Jamie, are you talking about the night of Carrie's party, when you went swimming with her?"
"I promised not to talk about that."
"This time it's okay, Jamie. What did Alan do after he kissed Carrie?"
"He gave her a hug and went home."
"Then what happened, Jamie?"
"The big guy hit Carrie and he pushed her in the pool."
"Jamie, are you sure?"
"Cross my heart. Daddy used to call me big guy, right, Mom?"
"Yes, Jamie, that's right. But remember, we don't talk to anybody about what happened the night Carrie went to heaven. That's our secret."
"Cross my heart, Mom. I didn't tell anyone."
Following his usual routine, after dinner, Jamie went upstairs to watch television. Heavy-hearted, Marge stayed at the kitchen table and made herself another pot of tea. She was starkly aware of what Jamie had told her. If Jamie was describing what he saw the night Carrie was killed, then Carrie was still alive when Alan left.
Might Alan have come back and killed Carrie? I guess